John Fain.
On radio, online and on digital.
Conversation Hour on 774 ABC Melbourne
and on ABC Victoria.
My co-host, comedian Sammy J.
Good morning, John. How are you going?
Got a new trick up your sleeve.
In a way, it's a brand new election show. It's starting today. I'm doing a new episode every day for the next 3 weeks.
Every day?
I thought the election, it just wasn't kicking up a notch, this campaign. I thought it needs something.
It needs you.
Well, it needs someone. It is someone doing things like this.
We're looking at pictures today. Bill from Mooney Pond sent us this picture of a bus. Vroom, vroom. And Malcolm from Point Piper sent us this original oil painting in the style of McCubbin. Gee, I think it is a McCubbin. Should get that valued.
These are sort of like playground, play school sort of little snippets?
Yeah, the show school. ABC asked me whether I would like to do something for the election and... You know, I didn't want to do something that's already being done. There's lots of great election comedy out there at the moment. And
where? My,
all over the ABC, John.
Where?
All every time you interview a politician.
Oh, that sort of comedy?
Yep.
Yeah, right.
So I'm doing a show. I pitched a show called...
I watched The Chaser's Desk the other day.
Mm.
Nah.
Very long desk.
Well, very long show.
I enjoyed it. It was difficult at times to concentrate on who was talking because there are so many heads there. But I did enjoy seeing Tony Jones's little cameo.
Well, literally half a second. No, it was... the thing about it is when it's on free-to-air TV, there's half an hour and you have to fill half an hour.
Mm.
When you watch it on iView, you suddenly realise, well, this doesn't have to be half an hour long because it's on iView. I can whip through it as fast as I like. And it kind of cuts down to just a couple of gags and the rest was fluff and padding.
I was really
disappointed. I'm a huge fan of Chaser and this was really... Not up to standard.
Well, look, my show is perfect for you because the episode's about 4 minutes long and they're going out on iView. So look at that.
4 minutes.
Four or five, depending on the content of the day. But I'm filming it at midday every day.
Okay.
And it goes up at 5 o'clock. So it's a very quick turnaround, Monday to Friday.
So is it musical?
It's called Playground Politics. And so my idea was, what about a show explaining the election to toddlers around Australia? Now, obviously, the audience is actually adults, but I'm doing it very much in the play school style. We could be doing things like... learning how to build an immigration detention centre out of a shoebox. And
are you infantilising? Is that what? No, that's fantasising. Infantilising. There's got to be a word there somewhere.
Respecting the audience. I think that's the word. No, I thought it would just be a fun, different approach. So I've got little Malcolm doll, little Bill doll. We're making Bill's campaign bus. It's all very gentle. You know, and it's very, play school is not the target. That's the form. So it's just... the genre. There's no swearing. There's no nastiness. It's just playing with these dolls, putting politicians to bed. Oh, Malcolm's rolled a little bit to the right. Let's just fix it up there, you know. And every day there'll be little songs and activities. Today I'm going to teach kids how to make a Faustian pact with the Lord of the Underworld, for example. Just little things like that. And it's going to be fun. I'm starting to question whether I should have committed to 3 weeks worth. That's 15 episodes.
That's 15. 15 little snippets.
And at the end, the ABC, I believe, are going to throw it into a bit of a TV compilation. So it's going to be a fun and stressful few weeks ahead.
Oh, well, you've got, I suppose, you have to have a forensic approach to the news to look for the little spark that triggers the next day's contribution.
Absolutely. And, you know, I do love my news and my politics, so it's sort of a dream job for me getting to play in this world. But the office at the moment is just a whole wall of flashcards with possible topics because it's amazing how quickly things move, you know. A few weeks ago, it was all negative gearing and then suddenly we thought childcare would be a huge thing, but it seems to have been neutralised to an extent, you know, in the news cycle at least. And so it's difficult to keep up. So a lot of half-formed ideas that I'm just waiting to see which ones will make it into the show.
And it has to be national.
Has to be national, of course.
Which means that, for instance, a candidate who didn't disclose an investment in a brothel might not be making national news?
So far it has, you know. Certainly on Insiders it got a few runs the other day. It's fascinating trying to also just work out which politicians might possibly be interested in appearing on a show like this because I've been making overtures. And naturally, politicians are a little bit suspicious when a comedian approaches them.
Yes, rightly too.
I've had a few maybes and I've had one yes, John.
One?
One yes, this Wednesday. I think once one person appears and it goes well, others will start lining up to be on the show. But
define goes well for me, please.
Makes them not look like an absolute buffoon. I think that's the
tempting
benchmark.
As it might be. what you'll do is you'll be really nice to the first few. And then towards the end of the 3-week run, you can really let rip because it's by then, hey, so what? Doesn't matter anymore.
Well, we'll see. It's ABC, though. It's got to be objective.
Of course.
It's an equal opportunity offence.
Got to meet the guidelines. So are we allowed to know who's said yes? Who's your first victim?
Not at all, because I don't want to jeopardise it, because I don't believe they're going to turn up until... I'm in the studio on Wednesday, and until that moment, I'll have another sketch ready to go just in case.
It might be... I mean, some politicians are very good at taking the mickey, and others are very thin-skinned.
Yeah, and I think they're rightly concerned, of course, because, you know... My job is to try and be funny. Their job is to try and make people like them. And those two don't always meet in the middle.
But, and you see this with the Chaser stunts, you know, with the sorts of things that over many, many years that team very, very effectively have done, which is where you, in fact, sometimes got the very best glimpses behind the facade of the controlled facade of the professional politician.
Absolutely. And that's an example where, you know, this show is not about stunts because, you know, the Chaser do them wonderfully. So for me, it's more about the different forms. So if I can have a politician singing a happy song with me, making a cake with me in the form of this or that, you know, little things like that that will be fun and entertaining, but not particularly nasty or anything. That's the dream.
You could make submarines out of toilet paper rolls.
It's a brilliant idea. I might file that one away, John. Also, I've got a.
I would
you
like
might
to see that
the
because
show.
You could save tens of billions of dollars if we could only use some of those different toilet paper rolls.
Well, it is all about craft. Like, for example, tomorrow we know Shorten's on Q&A tonight, so I have half a Q&A sketch written, and I'm waiting to fill in the rest of the lines based. Oh. And the set is beautiful. I've got three little egg cartons, and the audience are the little eggs, and they're ready to ask the little...
With faces on them?
Little faces, drawn in texture, of course.
And then Tony Jones is like a bigger egg?
Oh, well, that's offensive to Tony, John.
A duck egg?
Don't let your jealousy stand in the way of
not
your
jealous,
objectivity.
Not in the slightest, but a duck egg could be Tony Jones.
Well, we've actually got a fabric doll of Tony Jones, John. It's even better. And I don't want to give too much away, but I have penned a song called I'll Take It As a Comment, and... That's ready to go for tomorrow.
Oh, very good.
If you make the news, John, as I'm sure you will, you might make it into the show yourself.
Look, we've only made the news once this campaign so far, which was when Malcolm Turnbull told me that I should stump up to buy a house for the kids if they're suffering. I asked him about housing affordability, to which his reaction was you should stump up and buy your kids a house, and that kind of triggered... You know, several days worth of media frenzy.
As a comedian, I was listening to that live, I remember, in the kitchen, and I remember hearing that comment. You know, at the time, it was all very gentle. I thought, that's gonna come back to bite me.
Well, immediately I said, well, that's hardly a housing policy, which has got lost, I might say, somewhere in that. But it's one of those, housing policy's just vanished as an issue, long gone now.
And we've got 3 weeks to go, and it is genuinely, you know, from an observer's point of view, it's quite fascinating to think, what is going to be the big topic in 1.5 weeks, in 2 weeks? I genuinely think we don't know, unless it really is, as some have been suggesting, the government is running the clock down, and they just don't want to talk about too much at all, because at the moment it looks like they're going to get over the line. So.
Well, they had a couple of bad weeks, then they had a good week, and that's where we're sort of up to now. Mm-hmm. 3 weeks to go, we'll see exactly where it's the sort of pendulum swings backwards and forwards.
Yeah, and probably just harm minimisation, just if they can get away with no gaffes, which is probably why none of them are yet agreeing to appear on my show. But you know,
and do you concentrate on the other minor parties, minor candidates, the Senate crossbenchers, the Greens, the Xenophons?
Absolutely, I'm particularly looking forward to you know having some fun with the Greens. You know, like as I say, I don't want to only appeal to one side of politics. I want everyone to be able to enjoy this, and that means kicking everyone, you know, equally and looking for their Achilles heel. So you know, it's been an interesting weekend for the Greens, of course.
Well, the Greens on the weekend were indignant because they wanted to do a deal. They couldn't do a deal. So then they said, that's appalling to do those sorts of deals. Whereas if they had been able to do a deal, they would have said, well, that's how politics works. But because they got the short straw, they're indignant.
Yep. My little Richard Di Natale doll, I think, is going to be filmed possibly, you know, dumpster diving, looking for preferences around the inner north.
Your Richard Di Natale doll.
Yes, I said that. Yes, I stand by it. I've got 12 dolls made, John.
Already?
They're all ready to go.
You got a Jackie Lambie doll?
Ooh, no, but I've got an A3 colour printer, and that's how quickly we can work on this shoestring budget show.
I did watch on the weekend, Jan and I watched, what's it called? Kitchen Cabinet.
Yes.
With Annabelle Crabb.
Oh, yeah, with Jackie. Lambie. That was very entertaining.
Very, very insightful. And you got a really good sense of what she's like as a person, not just as the sort of the little grabs you get in the news.
Mm. I believe Michaela Cash is on this week, which will be equally fascinating. And, you know, and then I think the final, will there be one more edition coming out before the election?
Oh, I guess they've already filmed them all.
Not necessarily, from what I hear.
Well, and they try and keep them topical.
Well, you know, I think you try and get the big guns.
Ah, oh, so they might do another one, a Shorten and... No, they've done Shorten and Turnbull.
Yes, but in an election campaign, you know, a few years ago, didn't they? They try and get the leaders back.
Get them back in.
Yeah.
A follow-up. Be interesting to see. Sammy J, you can watch out on iView. So where do we find it?
It'll be on iView at 5 o'clock every day starting today. I think they'll also be doing some Facebook releasing as well, which is a bit of a first. So the full episode's going out online. And then also on TV come election eve and election night.
On free-to-air?
Free-to-air.
Okay, but if you go to iView, are they going to come up on that first screen?
Up. I believe so, yes. And every day, 5 o'clock, brand new episode, and only 3 or 4 minutes long. So I think, hopefully, you know, just give your listeners a bit of fun on a commute.
Excellent, because I did like the little piece that Classic FM have contributed, the bomb that was played on Insiders, but it's been around a bit on ABC TV as well. Things like that really make this campaign bearable.
Yeah, something has to.
Sammy J, comedian. Sammy J's Playground Politics will be on ABC iView from 5 o'clock every day for the next 3 weeks. Something to look forward to. Speaking of people with a quirky approach to it all, Dr. Tony Atkinson has written his life story. It's just being published by Affirm Press. He was a footman to the Queen and waiter to Winston Churchill whilst but a student. He then went on to practice medicine later on in life and had all sorts of adventures, some exotic, some funny, some bordering on the unsuitable for print. He's a great raconteur. He's our guest, Dr. Tony Atkinson. And then you're going to meet Zunar, Malaysian political cartoonist, facing a possible 43-year prison sentence for sedition back in Malaysia, and explaining to us exactly why the pen can be mightier than the sword. Or can it? Those are our guests on The Conversation Hour this morning.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
Welcome, Tony Atkinson, Dr. Tony Atkinson, to our studio. He's written his remarkable life into a book. It's called A Prescribed Life. A Prescribed Life. And Tony Atkinson served as a footman to the Queen, in particular, on the day of the coronation. Tony Atkinson, good morning to you.
Hello, John.
And welcome and congratulations on a remarkable life.
Thank you. Thank you. Good to be here too.
The story of how you became footman to the Queen is, of course, the logical starting point. There's some magnificent photos in here of you in all your finery. How did it come about?
Well, as a medical student, I did a lot of waitering, and the palace staff do shift work, and they come out on ordinary jobs like serving at weddings and fashionable balls and ordinary waitering jobs because they do shift work at the palace and they work very long hours. But sometimes when the Queen goes to Balmoral, say, they have a lot of spare time. So I got to know quite a few of the palace staff when I was a waiter. And incidentally, I was a medical student, but there were very few students who actually worked because it was after the war and I think most of them were on government grants and it might interfere with their government grant if they worked. So I seemed to be the only student that worked because I wasn't in the forces. I was knocked back on medical grounds. And so I got to know some of them and one night I was in doing a job for a press baron. It was about 3 or 4 in the morning, and my friend Albert, who was a long-term footman at Buckingham Palace, he'd been there for 17 years, I said to him, you're looking very glum, Albert. It's about 3 o'clock in the morning, and he said, yes, well, my wife dropped the baby out of the cot onto the floor, and I'm very worried, and I want to get home. So I went home with him. He had an apartment in Clarence House where the Queen Mother was. And I did a neurological examination on the baby.
Even though you were just a medical student.
Yes, I had no idea really what I was doing. the experience of the completely sort of innocent, I said, this baby is going to be quite all right the next day. Well, fortunately, the baby was. And over a cup of tea in the kitchen, Albert said, you know, in 18 months or so, the coronation's coming. Why don't you apply to the sergeant footman for a job as a footman? And I'll put a good word in for you. And that's really how it happened. I had a long interview with the sergeant footman, and he seemed to think I was all right, and I had experience of waiting at table and things like that, and serving on the right side, delivering food and wine and things. So that's how I got the job, really.
Can you describe in detail the attire? The list of the accessories that came with the position is astonishing.
Yes, I was fitted with three lots of livery, one for mourning in black and one for ordinary occasions, well, investitures and things like that, and then the state livery, which you wore for state occasions, state banquets, coronation, anything that was very elaborate and state livery was required.
We're talking 1950, but it looks more like 1650 in the photos.
Yeah, well, the livery was dated from George the Fourth. So,
stockings
and velvet breeches, buckle shoes that dug into your insteps, and a Georgian coat, very heavy coat,
made of.
It had three lots of linings, buckram was included, and I suppose, I don't know what it was made of.
Puffy sleeves and gold buttons and braid everywhere.
Huge buttons and brass, gold braid everywhere, and it was extremely heavy, and really you had to have a dresser to help you put it on. It was so heavy.
And then you had to have powder in your hair.
And then a powderer came along and powdered your hair carefully, making sure it didn't go anywhere except on your head where it should go. It was called powder, but really I think it was French chalk and flour, because it was very difficult to get off. What you did was strip to the waist, washed your hair, this was in the footman's dressing room, and you combed the hair and left the soap in, and then the powderer would come along and powder your hair. A lot of them were bald. I mean, I was 20 years younger than any of the other footmen. and then trying to get it off was a nightmare. But I used to turn up to the hospital the next day, and the surgeon would say, "What's this elderly student doing amongst us?" So it was very difficult to get off.
Tony, I have to ask, from the front cover of the book, this is the day of the coronation. The Queen is walking right past you, and it looks like you're suppressing a chuckle, or at least a smile.
Oh, yes. Well, that she was coming back from the Abbey, having been crowned, and Prince Philip was behind her, and she had the orb and scepter in her hands, and he just said, "Don't drop the bloody thing." And she was suppressing a smile, and I was too, and he was roaring with laughter. There is a full picture of that that was printed in the European and American papers, but the English papers didn't print the whole negative because they thought it was unroyal.
You've kind of had, I mean, all your stories about the palace and roaming around the private quarters and getting up to all sorts of hijinks, and then your stories about medical school and all the rest of it as well, are somewhat unconventional, Tony, because you do tell us warts and all. Most people who have led a distinguished life are somewhat more, might I say, censorious.
Yes, I was careful not to call it a memoir. I thought if you're going to write an autobiography, everything should go in. So a lot of the things I was exposed as extremely stupid person, and I thought everything should go in, so it makes it a better read.
Well, it certainly is, and not just at Buckingham Palace, but you spent some time at 10 Downing Street as well.
Yes, when Winston Churchill was elected in the 50s, re-elected, Clementine Churchill found the catering at 10 Downing Street pretty bad when the Attlees were there. So she involved Fortnum and Mason, who didn't do outside catering, but they did for the town at 10 Downing Street, and the food was much better and a good quality. And so any visiting dignitaries or royalty or anything, and everyone, of course, wanted Winston Churchill to entertain, and he did entertain a lot. He was in his 80s, so he's pretty old, but at the end of a dinner, he'd always make an extremely good street speech. Before the guests came, you could hear him in the entrance at 10 Downing Street practicing his speech and proper pauses and how it would go and brushing up Shakespeare quotations and things like that.
So he could be spontaneously erudite.
That's correct, yes. during the dinner, he looked as though he was half asleep, but suddenly he'd make a remark and amuse everybody, and they were all surprised that at the end of the dinner he made an excellent speech.
Was he as much of as fond of a tipple as history judges him to be?
Yes, of course there's a lot of wine and alcohol at the dinners, but he kept to his brandy, I think it was, and we weren't allowed to dilute the tumbler of brandy he liked. So he looked as though he was a bit under the weather, but he actually wasn't, really.
Now, moving from his vices to yours, I believe some of the food at Downing Street would occasionally make its way home in your pockets.
Yes, my sisters had lined my deep tailcoat pockets with plastic, and because at that time in the 1950s, England was going through still a lot of rationing, tea, meat, pretty well everything was rationing, and my mother was not starving, but she had to eat very simply. So these elaborate banquets, there was a lot of people, they didn't seem to cater for special diets or anything. So if they had a vegetarian, say somebody like Gandhi was visiting, he'd just have to eat the vegetables on the plate and leave the meat and, it was a whole juicy steak untouched. Well, that was slipped in my pocket on the way down to the kitchen downstairs. And the same with lobster. Some people were allergic to lobster and didn't touch it. So that went into my plastic lined deep pocket as well. And my mother was very pleased when I brought all this food back. And in fact, she had so many lobsters that she made fish pie of the lobster. And I rather tactlessly, years later, said to my wife, "Your fish pie is not quite the same standard as my mother's." And she said, "Oh, well, you'll have to bring three lobsters home and I might get it up to standard."
Why did you choose, given that you were moving at the highest level of London society and you were a young doctor and your family were reasonably, they'd had a great start in life, although your father died young, why did you choose to go across to the other side of the world and throw your lot in as a 10-pound pom, so to speak?
Oh, well, the truth is I really got fed up with the National Health. I'd trained in a lot of hospital jobs and very poor pay to become a general practitioner. And when I finally got a few positions as a general practitioner, I found that you couldn't even get, if you wanted to diagnose a patient, you had to send them off to hospital. You'd have to get an X-ray or a hemoglobin or whatever it was you wanted. They'd go to the outpatient of the hospital, and so they would diagnose the patient. So you weren't using your brain much. And so that's really one of the reasons I took up anaesthetics. And I've always was keen on anaesthetics, but I gradually drifted into anaesthetics full time. And I came over to Australia. Before I came to Australia, people said, Well, if you're in general practice in Australia, you might be in the outback and you've really got to know how to give an anaesthetic. So I did an anaesthetic job and I liked it, and I did it a couple more, and then I took further exams and became an anaesthetist eventually.
But the choice of Australia out of the whole of the world, you could have gone anywhere. Why did you choose to come here?
Well, we met quite a few Australians in London, and they all seemed bright and funny and didn't care about things too much. And it seemed to be a very attractive place to go. My family weren't at all pleased because they thought I'd never see me again. But the offer of being a £10 pawn seemed too good to be true, really. So my wife and my two very young children, we all set forth and came by ship here and, never looked back, really.
Is it strange now, you know, living on the other side of the world for so long, obviously, you look back at a photo like that, photos of you in this historic moment, does it feel surreal? Do you still feel that connection?
It does feel surreal, really, all the different sort of jobs I've done and looking back, I wrote the book because being an immigrant, your family doesn't really realise what you've done before you came here. So I thought they would be fairly interested in what I had done. In truth, they weren't. I don't think they really were. And people said, oh, you've got a few stories. Why don't you write a book? So that's how it all happened, really.
With Lynn Smales, Tony Atkinson's memoir is Of Royalty, Romance and Medicine, A Prescribed Life from a Former Queen's Footman to a £10 POM. Retired GP and anaesthetist, former president of the Medico-Legal Society, Dr. Tony Atkinson's story is A Prescribed Life. It's just published by Affirm Press with that iconic photo of Her Majesty on her coronation with a giggling Tony Atkinson visible in not even the background. He's right there next to her, helping the Queen Mother and the Queen with the train of her magnificent coronation gown, all the rest of it. He was right there. Tony Atkinson, Dr. Tony Atkinson's book, A Prescribed Life, published by Affirm Press, with some gorgeous illustrations of you, Tony, and your finery. Yes. Sammy J, my co-host, and stay with us, Tony, because our next guest, the Malaysian cartoonist Zunar, who is facing a 43-year prison sentence for sedition back in Malaysia for cartoons. That's right, for cartoons. Now, there's a country that's going through some stresses and strains. That's next on The Conversation Hour.
On 774 ABC Melbourne.
And our next guest today is the Malaysian cartoonist Zunar, full name Zulkifli Anwarul Haq, who is going back to Malaysia after his tour of Australia to face a trial that could see him jailed for more than 40 years for sedition. Zunar, good morning to you.
Good morning.
You're a dangerous man.
Yeah, for some.
What are you being prosecuted for?
Actually, I'm a political cartoonist. Before that, maybe I explain a big background of me. I'm a political cartoonist in Malaysia. My focus in my cartoons are corruption and injustices. There's two main focus. So I don't draw cartoon about other things. So then last year, when I criticized the judiciary and the government via my cartoon and also my tweet posting, on the judgment on Anwar Ibrahim, the opposition leader in Malaysia, where now he spent 5 years in jail. So for me, this is just a plot to prevent him from taking part in coming general election. That is my point in my cartoon and my tweets. And after that, I was arrested and now facing 9 charges under sedition law.
9 charges of sedition for cartoons and tweets, which are critical of the government. Now, there's a major corruption scandal underway in Malaysia. Mm. Are there other cartoonists, commentators, journalists, other people who are being treated the same way as you?
So far, there's no, but people are scared. This sedition law, people are very, very afraid to speak up, but I know in their heart they are not very happy, but they are really There are several laws. The sedition law is one of them. They have also official secret acts. Mm-hmm. For the journalists, if you reveal something, you will be punished under this law. And they also have, recently the government just introduced new National Security Council, and where the Prime Minister can now have a power to declare emergency if he thinks that his position is under threat.
Which it is, because he can't explain how a couple of $1 billion ended up in his bank account. The people do want an answer to that, and that means his position is under threat.
Yeah. That is why for me, as an artist and as a cartoonist, this is our duty. For me, talent is not a gift. Talent is a responsibility. That's why I'm showing example to my people. When we see this corruption, we have to make our stand clear and stand up. In my cartoon, my philosophy of cartooning is, how can I be neutral even my pen has a stand? So this is how I think it's very, very important. And I introduce for me a safest way, yet powerful way of protest. Laughter is the best protest. If you cannot beat them, laugh at them. No regime in the world can stand if people keep laughing at them. So that is my cartoon.
I couldn't agree more, but it just feels it's so such a wide gulf at the moment. Here I am about to do this, you know, making fun of our national politicians here, just literally just going to town, really can say what I want.
Yeah.
You're doing something similar but facing jail. I almost can't comprehend that, you know, from my perspective and what we take for granted here.
There are people who think you should go to jail too.
Naturally, John, but, you know, you run your own website to that effect, and I will argue against you.
Yeah, but we hope that by doing this we'll achieve what what you achieve here. It's just some freedom where you can, you know.
It's but, at great personal cost, isn't it? If you go back, you're quite liable to end up in jail.
Yeah, but we have to break the system.
Yes, that's, you know, very
are,
brave of you, aren't
you? Yeah, where people in Malaysia and everywhere, they have an imaginary line in their mind. I call it a line of fear, where you draw your own line of fear and you trap in that. So we need to, that's why I want to go back to face trial. Cross the line of fear. And see what is the other part of line. You know, if everybody facing a problem or threat by Malaysian government, and they keep escaping that, I mean avoiding that by go to other country, they will never solve a problem. The law will be there.
And will the trial be publicized in Australia and Europe and?
That's the purpose of my tour. I want to create awareness to the awareness, peoples, that this is the type of law I'm facing.
Is it in public court? Is it an open
trial?
It's
a public court.
And are you allowed to be represented by an independent lawyer?
That's right.
Have you got somebody who is prepared to take on the same fearless approach that you yourself have got?
I have a good lawyer. So they are doing pro bono work for me, where they also believe in the cause. But it, in Malaysia, it doesn't matter whether you have a good lawyer or you have good evidence or witnesses. The important thing is who is the judge, because the system is corrupt.
So even the judiciary is
is not independent. Mm. So you see in Anwar Ibrahim trial, you can see that this is all politically motivated.
The former opposition, well, he's still the opposition leader, the opposition who's been in jail too. So, Zuna, public sentiment in Malaysia, is it changing? The people on the street, as they're called, the masses?
You know, in previous general election, which was held in 2013, the opposition got 53% of popular vote. And the numbers keep increasing now after the huge corruption issues in Malaysia, where the Prime Minister, you know, we call it 2.6 billion corruption in ringgit. So people start to cannot take it anymore. There are some people in Malaysia, they still can tolerate million, but not billion. So this is too much to. So, but that is why now government introduced so many laws to make sure that they will can still control. They are now mooting an idea to control the internet.
So, easily done.
Yeah, because they're not.
China's doing it. Why can't Malaysia?
But Malaysia is not blocking internet, but the content of the internet.
Yeah,
the content of the internet. So because the government feel that people now, you know, in Malaysia, Twitter and Facebook is not social media. It's not social media. It's an alternative media.
They're not allowed?
No, alternative media where people go to get alternative views.
Yeah.
As all mainstream media are controlled by the government.
Even Facebook and Twitter.
Facebook and Twitter, they cannot control. That's why people go. People go there and people
express. Oh, so they're going
express,
to Facebook and Twitter.
People express their view. People express protest, frustration. People laugh at the government, whatever they do.
And Twitter is one of your biggest platforms, isn't it? Because your books have been banned.
Seven of my books have been banned by the Malaysian government. Because for them, the contents are detrimental to public order. But what I can say now, from previous generation, now in Malaysia, we have a minority government, actually. And this can create a paranoia, you know, and also they live in a very inferior complex.
One of the things from outside that we don't understand is why there's not more of a popular uprising when something is as corrupt and so obviously wrong as this is, a prime minister with billions in a bank account, and the French have said what's going on, the international community have said what's going on. I think, you know, everyone involved has said, oh, for goodness sake, come on. And you just think, well, why aren't there? I mean, if that happened in Australia, I'd confidently say, Zunar, well, I hope I'm right in saying that there would be thousands of people out in the hundreds of thousands of people out on the street demanding something change, and it would. Mm-hmm. It would change, and we've seen a few instances over the years of those sorts of popular protest movements having an impact. But what's happened? Why does that not happen in Malaysia? Are people that scared?
There are three groups of people in Malaysia. One is they're scared because you know the government now have a new law to control the public assembly. That means those if you go to the street, there are new law to counter that now.
So you have to get a permit.
Illegal permit, and the police will come and beat you up.
Is that based on the number of people assembled?
Or? Yeah, it's the number of people. There cannot be more than seven. More than seven.
Okay.
It's considered illegal.
So if there's 10 people or 100 people or 200 people, they can do something about that. But what if there's 200,000 people?
Yeah, I know.
What do they do about that?
I know. We have a bersih, we call it bersih protest every year, more than 500,000 in the street.
So and still no change?
Still no change because against the government control all the institution. So the middle class is intact. People can go to the street, but the police is still with the government, with the corrupt government, and the judiciary with them, and the media also with them, and they will portray this as this is not there's not the people who want change. These people are the troublemaker. So that's how they portray it.
But how about elections? Aren't there elections, or are they fixed too?
The election is full of fraud in Malaysia and gerrymandering. People know about it. Full of fraud and gerrymandering. That's why it is very difficult for us to as if it's a very long and hard way to go.
Now, I did read something, Zuna, one of the state elections or the provinces, the opposition succeeded, I think, in recent times for the first time. In
states where we have 13 states, two states already win by opposition, but the state
which
power,
is regarded as an opening up of
some opening
politics.
It's since 2008, things start to change. But we in Malaysia, we need more time to educate people about their right because we have been governed by the same political party for more than 60 years, and the government keep telling them. Changing is very, very risk for your future if you change the government. And we have
that's what all governments say. Our governments say
we have racial riot. Yeah,
well, whoever's in power, well, people they
buy,
say that.
People buy that because we have racial riot in 1969. People say that if you change, then the riot will come back.
Yeah,
and people scared, but they already overcome it 2008. So there are two states win by election by the opposition, but now we still have to work hard because against the election commission. It's not independent. The judiciary is not independent.
And the police aren't independent.
The police is not independent. Yep. The attorney general, that is why the prime minister still enjoy it. The attorney general, according to the practice in Malaysia, the attorney general, if he want to prosecute someone, he has first get the approval from the prime minister. So in this case, as an example, I show to the prime minister, can I arrest you for corruption? The Prime Minister will say no.
And the previous leader has also come out and said that Najib needs to be Mahathir. Yeah, so that's been a seminal change. I'm not sure I want to hear your answer to my next question, Zuna. It's very important to ask.
Just try.
What is Australia's attitude to the corruption that's alleged in Malaysia?
What is Australia?
Australian government's attitude. Is the Australian government on the side of freedom or on the side of a superficially and fairly obviously corrupt regime?
I'm not expert in diplomatic relationship, but I can say that I think what Obama did is equal what Australian government is taking stand now. When Obama visited Malaysia last year, his only concern is for the Prime Minister to sign the TPPA agreement.
The free trade agreement.
So it's about trade. It's not about human rights. So now diplomatic relationship is all about trade and personal interest. I think Australia, correct me if I'm wrong, I think Australia has a very good relationship in trading with Malaysia, one of the biggest partners. They don't want to jeopardize that.
That must feel very lonely for you, though, if you're heading back to a September trial and you don't feel like even your neighbouring countries are necessarily interested or active in this sort of situation. Do you know, what is the likelihood of you heading to jail in September? Do you have any idea or is it anyone's guess?
I don't want to think so far ahead for me because I don't want to create, I don't want that to affect my works. I don't want to create self-censorship to me. So for me, next week is matter. Well, I don't want to try to think, what type of prison life do I, need to, can I draw in the, prison wall? People, I don't want to think about that. Even though I've been arrested several times before and spent time in police lockup. But for me, now, if you ask me, I just concentrate what I'm supposed to do as an artist. I don't really care what the government want to do. So this is the attitude.
In your experience, as you just mentioned, when you're in a police lockup, for example, on the ground, are those looking, charged with your custody in those moments, do you find that they're at times supportive of you, but they're just obviously, following orders, as it were?
Or yeah, that's correct. Some officer told me that. Yep. They have to. They know what is wrong, what is right, but they are following order. And that's not good for the government.
How about your employer? Does he get into trouble for employing you as a cartoonist?
I am on my own. Oh. I don't have editors, but I work for the website called Malaysia Kini, where I send them cartoon every day. It's only on website, and they have trouble too before. Yeah. The police raided their office, and also my office. We have that the problem, but again, we need to go on. The thing is, this won't stop me. In one of the investigation, I told the police that you can ban my books, you can ban my cartoons, but you cannot ban my mind. I will keep drawing until the last drop of my ink.
And it's not just the role of the Australian government that we should think of, but Australian business, which is heavily involved with lots of Malaysian trade and investment, And all of that is, well, it's not possible to do business with some countries in not just Southeast Asia, in Africa, in Central Asia, in the former Soviet republics and China. It's simply not possible to do business in these places without in some way offering support to regimes that are just intrinsically, fundamentally corrupt. And we're seeing that played out here. So whether Australia as a country, but Australia also as a trading partner, has responsibilities on human rights is a very fair and reasonable question, but one that doesn't often get asked, Suna. Mm. It's just too hard for a lot of companies and businesses to ask.
Yeah, I believe that the important thing is the fight has to come from Malaysia. We have to do it.
From Malaysian people?
Yeah, Malaysian people have to do it.
Sorting out Malaysian
Others,
problems.
Others, they can only help. But well, they are. I mean, if they want to help, there's only help. We cannot initiate that from. You don't expect that America can come to tell the Malaysian Obama come to Malaysia and tell the Prime Minister Najib, please release this, please abolish the Sedition Act. No way.
And Malaysia, you're confident the modern state of Malaysia, the Federation of Malay States, can survive a peaceful transition to government, and this sort of upheaval. You don't think it'll all fragment, fall apart? And
we know, never have that experience before. But again, if you don't do that, you will never know. So we have to try. We have to try. But again, there is nothing worse than being governed by the same political party for 60 years.
Well, it is. In itself, it's
People make a comparison. Okay, you change a government in Egypt. After that, you face trouble too.
Yeah.
But you say,
and Burma, now Burma's gone through a peaceful transition gradually.
Yeah.
So it is possible.
It's possible, yeah.
Suna, we will watch with great interest, and I salute you for having the courage of your convictions, and I wish you all the very, very best in your battle in September in the courts in Malaysia.
Yeah, thank you for
having me. The Malaysian political cartoonist Suna, full name Zulkifli Anwar Ul Haq, who is going back to Malaysia to face a trial which may result in 43 years in prison. Tony Atkinson's book, A Prescribed Life, Royalty, Romance and Medicine, published by Affirm Press. From a former Queen's footman and 10-pound pom to a life here in Australia. Tony Atkinson, thank you for joining us. And Sammy J, let's have a look at 5 o'clock, Playground Politics on iView. Thank you all for coming. This has been The Conversation Hour on your ABC.